Africans at home and throughout the diaspora. Unity is strength. We've got the power.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now's the time to do the right thing.
We need more unity. Come.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now's the time to do the right thing.
In the spirit of umoja, embrace with love.
Good afternoon. This is the day after some primaries. This is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield, and we have quite a discussion today. This is Black Commentator Roundtable Day, and we are missing one of our folks, so it's not a roundtable. It's going to be a dialogue between me and my good friend, Elwood Watson. Welcome, Elwood.
How are you doing today? Glad to be here.
Yes. We got some things to talk about. We're going to break them down to maybe three things. One of them is the election results that were critical, and I'm going to talk about St. Louis in particular, and then some of the national races, and then whatever was happening in Tennessee that's worthy of discussion. I want you to add those, and then we're going to talk about the war, and then we're going to talk about pedophilia, because one of our Black commentator contributors has been missing in action because they've been dealing with a pedophile at their church. And so we're going to talk about that and weave it into this whole global thing around pedophiles and how it's impacting us, not just globally, but locally, because they're in our churches, they're sometimes in our families. And so we need to confront this head on. This is Voices from the Battlefield, where we connect these struggles, we talk about these struggles, we give solutions to these struggles, or at least our opinions about how we can resolve some of these issues. But there is a lot going on. I mean, the world is literally burning, you all. When you say hair on fire, we got fires in Europe that they've never seen or witnessed before or experienced before. We got fires going on in, and I'm talking about like brush fires going on in the western part of the United States. So we are still dealing with environmental issues that are, for the most part, man-made. And because they're man-made, they can be man-solutioned. And so we just need to recognize that that is a global phenomenon that also is connected to global capitalism. So having said that, I really was both inspired and disappointed by some of the results of the elections last night. So in Missouri, which we were the focus of two issues here, because I'm talking about nationally, we were looking at the congressional race between Cori Bush, who was trying to get her seat back from what's that boy's name?
Wesley Bell.
And then we had a ballot initiative that we were waiting for. So Cori did not get her seat back. And the same issue that was going on in Michigan with what I call AIPAC candidates is what was happening here. I mean, there was so much money in this race. Wesley Bell, to some cases, people were reporting that they were getting 9 mailers in one day from him. And of course he had back-to-back TV ads, just a lot of money. And, you know, I was revisiting the AIPAC tracker, and I've told my listeners about this website. You can go see who's getting AIPAC money and how much, particularly your own elected officials. And a bunch of them are getting AIPAC money. AIPAC is the Zionist political action pack where all this money is funneled through. So apparently the main thing you have to do to get all this money is to support Israel and the genocide against the Palestinian people. So 30 million was tossed in that race in Michigan, and they lost. So Abdul El Saeed won by one percentage point, and that might seem insignificant. Of course, we're going to take it, but the kind of money that was spent there was I think was the largest amount spent in any Senate race ever. That's how much money they got to spend on candidates, y'all. So yesterday, when I was revisiting the APAC tracker, you know, they have you can put in your elected official, congressional official, and see if they're getting money. But they also have a Hall of Shame, and Wesley Bell is the second person on the Hall of Shame because he gets $12 million from APAC. So that gives you some idea of the kind of money that these people have to buy folks off. And what I thought was interesting is that both Wesley Bell and Sharon, what was the candidate's name? What Elwood in Michigan, the one that was running against Saeed.
Oh yeah, her name becomes escapes, but was it Wells? Her last name was Wells, I forget, but it was but she
Sharing somebody, but yeah. So both of them, I thought it was interesting that both of them have said on occasion that they don't believe there is genocide in Gaza, and I thought that was very strange because to me, then that's connected to why they get the money. But just recently, Wesley Bell was confronted by a Jewish person at one of the rallies or whatever, and was asked about him
It was Haley
supporting.
Stevens.
Haley Stevens. Haley Stevens. But Wesley Bell said that it's not genocide because there's casualty on both sides. Now, I don't know if he was just being ignorant or whether he really believes that. That is not the definition of genocide, that you have casualties on both sides. So that gives you some indicators of when people get this money, what they say and do. And the fact that Cori Bush lost to a candidate that was getting lots of APAC money to support the Jewish state and the genocide of Palestinians meant that here in this state, we got some work to do. We got some work to do because some of the things I heard was that, well, we're not about all this global stuff. We're about what's here at home because Cori Bush, of course, was pretty active around Palestinian issues when she was a congressperson. And so the work that I'm talking about doing, Elwood, is how the global economy affects us locally. So the fact that we have a war that Trump decided to go into without authorization by Congress, by no input from the citizens of this country, is affecting us locally. So farmers are being affected because of the tariffs, because of the oil, because of the price of gas.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can't. I don't know what happened, but you know, who knows who pulled that one. But yeah, we lost about 5 minutes. But for
That's okay.
those of us who are
We'll extend
rejoining,
it. We'll extend it. We'll extend it.
we are here at Voices from the Battlefield, and this is the first month Wednesday of the month, which means it's the Black Commentator Roundtable, and we have with us today Elwood Watson, and we were trying to delve into the results of the election, and I talked a little bit about St. Louis, and he was going to talk about what's happening in Tennessee. So go ahead, Elston. What's going on, Elwood?
Yeah, Tennessee right now, we have pretty much not too much going on here in the state. The people who are running were predicted to win. I think Marsha Blackburn's running for the governor's race. And it's closer than people thought, but I think she probably will pull it out. And we have a few young Justins, both Justins, one Justin out of Nashville is for the House. Like I said, and I think it'll be a competitive race. It's going to be uphill because we're in Tennessee. But I think he may have a good shot in November, but we'll see. But right now, there's not really too much going on in the Tennessee races because Tennessee is pretty much a very red state right now. Even a lot of Tennessee Democrats are kind of like, Democrat name only. It's almost like Massachusetts Republicans. They're kind of like Massachusetts Republicans or Renos. They're kind of Republican in name only. They're pretty much Democrats. But I think, and I think that's what you find out with a lot of in Tennessee, at least for the time being. There are pockets of the state, Memphis, you know, those kind of places, parts of Nashville, but Tennessee still right now, for the most part, pretty red. So there's not too much going on over there. I would like to make a mention what you mentioned about Missouri. Missouri, I think, in some ways, is still very parochial. You've got a fair amount of blacks in the state who are very conservative, relatively conservative too, centrist, I guess is a better word to use. And older blacks tend to vote in those primaries as opposed to younger blacks. And that's why I'm not really all that surprised that Wesley Bell won, because I think some of those people may see themselves as liberal. They're probably a lot more conservative than they realize they are. They still have that mindset about pragmatism, who can really win and who can really benefit for us. So I think they looked at the end of the day and said, well, Wesley Bell's probably going to be able to deliver for us more than Cori Bush, even though she may be more progressive in her views. But what is she going to be able to do long term for us? I think that's what they're looking at. And I think that's, I'm saying older voters. I'm saying younger voters may not see that. So I'm not really surprised there. Also, Wesley Bell got the endorsement of Jasmine Crockett. I don't know if you knew that or not. Jasmine Crockett. And I don't think he's not a right winger or anything by any means. He's not, Wesley Bell, but he's not as leftist as Cori Bush was. And I think that they were looking to say, we need to win this race. If Jasmine Crockett was quoted, we need to win this race. And I don't think she had anything personally against Cori Bush, but she was probably saying, are we going to be able to win this race with Cori Bush? We want to keep the seat, and can Cori Bush actually keep the seat, for us? And I think that's what she was probably saying, who's going to be more effective. You have a better gauge on Missouri politics than me, but I think that that's kind of what I gauge with that. Like I said, you're right there in that state, so you know the politics better than me. But that's what I would probably venture to say, that older voters in Missouri and those parts of the nation have tended to be more pragmatic voters, and they tend to be much more, centrist as opposed to leftist. Whereas in Michigan, you've got the auto workers, you've got the, Detroit, all the Detroit changes, you've got a lot more migrants who've moved in from that state. You've got the University of Michigan, you got Ann Arbor, you've got those college towns. So you're going to have a much more left of center, center left of center electorate who is fired up because of the economy there and the like. That really wouldn't surprise me that, more left of center candidates would do better in Michigan than they would in Missouri.
Well, like Tennessee, Missouri is a red state. We have a trifecta here. We got a Republican governor, Republican House, Republican Senate. So any movement is really going to be a uphill battle. But, I think the voters here in the state have prevailed. So one of the other things, in addition to the Cori Bush defeat and why, I think she was defeated, we had on that day, it wasn't necessarily on the ballot. In fact, it wasn't on the ballot, but we were supposed to hear from the Republican Secretary of State around the 300,000 plus signatures that have been collected for a ballot initiative in November. And this ballot initiative deals with the gerrymandering that the Republican legislature had done. So in between the census, which is when we have the redistricting map redrawn, they decided that they were going to do another map before the, and it's not written in law, but that had been the practice. It's like you wait till after you get a better sense of who the demographics are and what the population is. But they did a power grab. And so what they were trying to do is to eliminate the lone black congressperson in Kansas City. And so we collected all these ballot initiatives. This man had until 5 o'clock yesterday to tell us whether or not we had sufficient signatures for that to go on the November ballot. What did he do? He said, forget the number of signatures that were collected. This initiative is unconstitutional. So we expected that kind of shenanigans, that kind of politicking. And so, of course, we're going to go to court. But what he refused to do, even with the media, is tell us, tell the media, tell the public why it's unconstitutional. And if it is unconstitutional, why was nothing said before we started doing the petition? So that's the kind of games that are being played. But the beauty of yesterday is, and we talked about some ballot initiatives on the show last week because we wanted people to have enough information to inform their voter plan. And so we talked about the propositions and we talked about the amendments. So one of the amendments, Elwood, was to make ballot initiative harder to do. And so they were going to have a ballot initiative where every congressional district had to have a majority of votes for whatever ballot initiative is. And if you didn't have it in one, that was the end of the ballot initiative. Because we've been so successful, citizens have been so successful at putting things on the ballot that we couldn't get the legislature to do, impacting Missouri families. That's how we got paid sick leave. That's how we got, increased minimum wage for the state. That's how we got expansion of Medicaid. So when they don't do something, it forces citizens to have to do it on their own. And so, as you probably know, there's a lot of work goes into ballot initiatives and money. And so they were trying to make that harder for us to do. And so we are still, amendments 4 and 5, which the Republicans put forward, were like trounced on. Like 80% of Missouri voters said hell no to making ballot initiatives harder and to get rid of the state income tax. Because if... Awesome. Yeah, so 80%, that's not just the cities, that's not just urban areas, that was, suburban, that was farmers, that was 80%, that's a pretty damn high. So that lets you know that people are paying attention. And so I just want to say thank you to my woke listener, because you all went out and did your thing. And then on Prop M, which was a local proposition, that also almost received 80%. I think it was something like 78%. So that was really trying to modernize the city charter. So people are paying attention. They are, and I've been telling people, don't give up your vote, your voice, or your dollar, during this time, because all of those are very important. What do you think, Elwood, about the national trend when it comes to the DSA, this is Democratic Socialists of America candidates? And because one of the things that we see happening is that the Israeli supporters, that is the Zionists and AIPAC folks, are getting crushed. So you have voters in Colorado, Illinois, New Jersey, New York, who have rejected those AIPAC candidates in favor of progressive ones. And they haven't always been DSA candidates, but they definitely have been folks who are left to center. So there seems to be some acknowledgement that what's happening in Gaza is unacceptable, and people are using that as a criteria for how they support candidates. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I also believe too that there's a difference to me in Judaism as a religion and Zionism. They're two different things.
Absolutely. Okay.
And also there are a lot of Jewish people who are very critical towards Zionism. So let's make that clear. And there are a lot of Jewish people who are running, like the guy in New York, Lander, who got the backing of the mayor there, Jahan Mandami. He was and there are a lot of Jewish people who have been very critical of Netanyahu. Catherine Rampell, who is on MS now, used to be MSNBC, she said herself, she said there are a lot of Jewish people in America who do not like Netanyahu. There are a lot of Jewish people in Israel who don't like Netanyahu and what he's doing. And I think too many people conflate that if your person is Jewish, they're automatically supporters of Zionism. And we need to make that distinction clear. There are some of the staunchest opponents of Zionism are Jewish people. And so let's make that, we got to get that clear, because I think we want to make that division clear, because a lot of people assume if you're a Jewish person, you're automatically a Zionist. Not true at all. As a matter of fact, there are a lot of Christians who may be more supportive of Zionism, particularly right-wing Christians, than there are even Jewish people,
So
I think too many people conflate the two as being one and the same. That being said, Yes, I think, people are right now, like you said, Colorado, places like Texas, rural Texas. I think a couple of candidates, progressive candidates, one down there. Tallarico is neck and neck with, now he's center left probably, but he's neck and neck with Paxton, who's a very flawed candidate in Texas. So yeah, I think people are upset right now what they see. I think people are feeling that, that maybe, the nation, one nation Israel, has maybe a little too much influence on our policies. And they feel that, also too, I think more people, Americans tend to be economic, kitchen table, pocketbook voters. That's why Trump was able to get 12 to 14% of the black male vote and a larger number of votes of other men of color back in November 2024, and people in general, because the economy was what they don't necessarily look at other issues. People look at how, a lot of people look at how their pocketbooks are going. And if they feel they're not making it, then they feel the other party are going to throw you out. That being said, they came back home in November of 2025. A lot of those individuals did. And Latina women voted 73% for Kamala Harris. So that means Latina women overwhelmingly still voted for Kamala Harris. And the majority of Latino Americans did vote for Kamala Harris. Latino men, 55%, who voted for Donald Trump, but they came back this fall. So the point is, Latino voters tend to be more transient voters. Latino men, Latino women tend to be pretty consistent, like black women, as far as more Democratic voters. Now, women tend to be Democratic voters in general. It's almost like, to me, the Democratic Party tends to be the mommy party, and the Republican Party tends to be the daddy party.
The white daddy party.
Right now, the white father, the white suburban father, upscale party. So yes, but to get back, to circle back to your question, yes, that I think that because of that APAC, I think that it's more complex than just simply that. I think there are a lot of factors that come into play, but I do want to let a lot of people know we need to make that distinction between Judaism and Zionism. We do it because I think that, and also there are a lot of Jewish supporters of these Democratic Socialist candidates in Michigan and in Missouri and in Colorado and places as well. So I think we got to make sure that we get that clarified too,
And so Elwood, just to that point, I think the other side of that is oftentimes people will conflate criticism of Zionism as being anti-Semitic.
Oh,
So
absolutely. And that's absolutely.
it goes the other way too. So if you start talking about Zionism and Palestine, then people say, "Are you anti-Jewish? You anti-Semitic?" Well, no, I know exactly who I'm criticizing. I'm not criticizing the Jewish people. There is some solidarity with them because I think what's happening in Israel is the same thing that's happening in the U.S. They don't like Netanyahu. They see what he's doing, and like Trump, he's making their lives unsafe because as long as he's doing his war crimes, all of them are at risk. Because then you got folks that are going to be retaliating, and so the same thing here. This man is putting the average citizen here at risk because of what he's doing across the waters. We're not even all necessarily in Israel, I mean Palestine, but or Iran. And so I think that part of what the national media has the power to do is to confuse us with these narratives. And unless you really understand or are a critical thinker, then what looks like it's real, it's not really real. And and I'm not even talking about AI generated. I'm just talking about when you have a narrative that you're able to just keep saying over and over and over again and just bombarding with people. After a while, they say, well, maybe that's true.
That's why you have to do your homework and you have to do your research. You don't ever take anything at face value, whether it's totally from the left or the right. You need to go ahead and find out for yourself. Is that okay?
Absolutely.
Tim Wise, probably heard of. He's a Jewish man himself. He is very critical of Zionism. I mean, he's probably the socialist activist you can get, but he's very critical of Zionism. He's a Jewish man himself, Tim Wise. So I mean, so that's a good example of somebody. I'm using it. There are a number of people out there who are Jewish, proud to be Jewish people themselves that are their heritage, but they are very critical of Zionism and Netanyahu and what the Israeli government has been doing.
And when I think about war, which is one of the things that keeps coming up, is that the United States and its citizens, I don't think, still have understood, and you talk about narrative, have understood that most of the wars that we have been in for at least the last, well, probably since World War II, have not been wars to defend democracy. They have been wars to defend corporate folks and U.S. Yes. imperialism. And yes. so we've gotten used to being in wars, endless wars, but wars are very expensive. And when this government fights wars, it's to the detriment of citizens, because something's got to get cut. And when I think about how much money we're spending to fight Iran, and we still have no clear-cut objectives, nor have we seen any benefits for this country, except that some of the, you know, the war criminals are making money off the war, but we definitely are suffering. You know, I mean, they're making money hand and fist, so they don't give a damn if it keeps going or not. But we need to recognize that the wars that this government fights in our name with our money are rarely to defend the democracy, but they got us parroting that. Oh, we're fighting for our freedoms. We're fighting for democracy. These people don't like our democracy. No. These people are fighting in self-defense because the U.S. has been in their countries mucking around and causing strife and economic collapse based on the CIA. And so we are now getting more and more of that information through, documentaries and sometimes independent journalists. So it's no secret now what they've done in other countries. But the amount of money being spent on war is astronomical. And right now we're talking about if we ever get the Iranian war situation resolved, we are going to have to pay for the rebuilding of that country. And this is some of the stuff that's in the agreement. And it's just wild. Like, we paying to bomb them, and then we're going to pay to do the reconstruction. This is money out of our pocket. So at a certain point, we have to determine if we're going to be a country that really promotes peace and well-being of other countries, collaboration, rather than the approaches that we since World War II, where we just go into people's countries and kill their leaders, snatch their leaders like we did in Venezuela, what we're planning on doing, what we've been plotting on Cuba for many, many years. That kind of stuff us in the crosshairs, and this is the thing that I think citizens don't understand. When we over there messing with other people, they're thinking about how they can get back. They're thinking about how they're going to defend themselves. And so I just, this whole notion of endless wars, what's the best way to communicate that to citizens so they see that that's a direct impact on their lives, their pocketbooks, and it's not some faraway thing that doesn't affect them?
Well, I think that is beginning to happen. And I think wasn't necessarily a big fan of her, but Marjorie Taylor Greene, the former congresswoman out of Georgia, I think she was genuinely a good example of somebody who was genuinely upset and saying enough of these international conflicts. We need to be taking care of people here in the United States of America. I think she was genuinely sincere about that. Yes. I also think she was genuinely sincere about the Epstein files and those things as well. But yep. I do know that, but I think that, so I think, yes, you're right. You said it, in your previous, where both parties, let's keep it real, Democrats and Republicans, you've got military-industrial complex, politicians in both parties are making millions and millions of dollars off these wars. That's what it's about. They gave about 20 years ago, the Pentagon, maybe 15 to 20 years ago, the Pentagon told them we didn't need any more machines. They said, well, you're going to get them anyway, because they wanted that money to line their pockets. That's what it's about. It's the military industrial complex. And a fraction of that money that we're spending on these wars could take care of healthcare, public education, you know, all our ills, the infrastructure in this nation and everything else. It's just pure greed. Okay, that's what that is. And the reality is people are beginning to wake up to that. And some people are just, once they leave Congress, they feel they have nothing to lose. And they just go ahead and tell, they use the term to spill the tea. And they tell it like it is. And said, yeah, this is what's going on. And we're fed up with it. So yes, I do believe there's a growing number of Americans who are realizing that these perpetual wars, we don't want to be in them because they're not benefiting anybody but a small group of plutocrats.
And you talk about the industry that's producing the war machines. That's one thing. But now this phenomenon of betting on wars, which is creating another funding stream for these people. They're betting on who's gonna do a rocket, who's gonna, I mean, now it's at a whole different level, and these people are still making money hand over fist. And like you said, the infrastructure, the social needs here in this country are suffering because that money is not gonna go there. It's going to go towards the war, which is what Trump is all about. And I think it's going to be a minute before we totally wake up and start saying, stop sending money. Because when even elected officials start saying, stop sending money or we're not going to send money, they get accused of being unpatriotic, be accused of sedition, all kinds of stuff to make you feel, it's all gaslighting. And to make you feel ashamed that you even like put that forward. I remember when Barbara Lee, Congresswoman Barbara Lee, was the only one that was not for the war, one vote. And they pounced on her as being so unpatriotic. But at a certain point, the elected officials that we send up there, we have to send message to them that our money is not going to go for these wars to benefit. And as you say, line the pockets of these people who, they're not suffering at all. They don't even know the gas prices are up because they got chauffeurs that fill up their limousines, their cars. And so
Some of them probably know, they just don't care.
Well, that's true because they got the money to pay for whatever
correct.
It is.
Correct. That's what I meant.
Yeah. So I'm getting increasingly alarmed kinds of money that's going out the window, out of our pockets, towards. And I think that if they ever try to, in modern times, try to induce the draft, that you'll see a whole nother like upsurge, because these young people don't know about draft. These folks have been like volunteering for like a couple, you know, almost 20 years, really, since Vietnam. So they don't know what it means when somebody says, no, your butt lines up at this induction center and you getting ready to be shipped off. They don't know that.
And even then, it's a disproportionate amount of working class and lower income people who go to war for this nation.
Absolutely.
And, prior to the 1960s, 50s, it was always, you know, some point in your life before the boomer generation, whether you were rich, poor, or whatever, if you're a man, you're going to spend some part of your life in the military before college, after college. Now, you might have been in the reserves. You may not have been seeing combat or anything. But the point was, you were in the military in some capacity if you were male. That changed by the 1960s, you know, late, as well. But I think that because if you look at men of a certain age, it's very few. The ones who didn't serve in the military were probably in the minority. My father was a veteran and things like that as well. The majority of them served in the military in some capacity.
Yeah.
So I think, but now you're beginning to see, you know, a lot of people after that begin to change by the 60s and stuff as well. But yes, that will be opening a whole can of worms if that ever came to draft. I don't see a draft coming up anytime soon, given the type of wars we're facing today. But I do think you're going to always find people moving into the military.
Oh, and, yeah.
Branches of the military for different reasons. So yes, I concur with you on that score. But yeah, I think the nation right now, we're in a civil war, as I said in one of the previous podcasts that we did. We're in a civil war right now. There are a lot of things that I said that were happening in the 1850s that are happening today. Mark Twain said it best. History doesn't exactly repeat itself, but it does rhyme. And I think we're seeing we're in the throes of a civil war right now. Now, it's not like a war between the states in the 1860s, but we're definitely seeing it right now. And after that, the good thing about that was we went into a reconstruction after the Civil War. I do think we're going to go into a reconstruction of sorts. I myself am not so convinced it's going to be a racial reconstruction like it was in the mid-19th century, as it will be more of an economic reconstruction. And I think that's what you're going to see probably in the next 4 to 5 years. I think we'll see an economic reconstruction of some sorts, which would be good for the nation. That would be good.
Mm-hmm.
And I think looking at my historical lens on it, you know.
But I think the reconstruction, as I've been talking about, it means that we as a people have to begin to re-envision what we want in the next life. And I don't mean like the afterlife. I mean after all of this is done. Because if you look at the destruction of the West Wing as a metaphor for the destruction that's happening of not just the physical institutions in this country, the cultural institutions, the academic educational institution. But if you look at the destruction of democracy as the metaphor, and then you take the reflecting pool and as a metaphor reflecting what's going on, those two things ought to give us pause of what do we want to society to be after the Trump has done his damage. And some of that I think is irreparable damage, but some of it we have to track to make sure that we reverse it whenever we get the majority. And I'm not all that convinced that we'll get it soon just because we win the House and the Senate. But I think the people have proven that they are going to be the fourth branch of government and be the deciding factors. And we've been doing that across this last year with this man being in office and tearing down this, tearing down that, you know, reversing this law and tearing, you know, literally shredding the Constitution. But I'm thinking we, and this came up last night with some of the commentators who were talking about the elections, is that there's a lot of against Trump, anti-Trump, anti-Trump, but what are people saying is the alternative? What is the vision? And I keep telling my my movement people, we got to do better at articulating what the vision is. And I think some of the platforms of the DSA candidates is close to that. Like, it ought to be health care for all. There ought to be, you know, free or affordable child care. We ought to have, you know, the highest echelon of education systems that we can, and that's not happening. So it's just some basic things that we should be doing that really, I think, could turn the country around. What do you think?
Yes, and I think that if you hear that, and I think a lot of people are beginning to hear that, and I think a lot of those DSA candidates have done a very good job over the past 4 or 5 years under the radar, making sure that that is getting into those local communities. And when people actually hear what they're saying and saying, we believe in, you know, child care for others, we believe in, you know, I think, you know, public education, and, you know, that people should not have to be saddled with a whole slew of loans once they get out of school, and, you know, basic housing and things like that as well. I think people are saying, okay, well, this is something that resonates with me, particularly Gen Z, because right now those are the people who's going to affect, all those issues are going to affect in a very direct way, because they're young. Some of them maybe want to start, try to start families, or start their careers and feel like they cannot really get their foot in the door. So yes, these are the, I mean, and that's who they're appealing to, because they're saying, they're looking at the Gen Z's looking around and saying, this is terrible. I can't get a job. I can't, my degree, I've got hundreds of thousands of dollars of student loans or whatever. And, you know, this is just, I'm already, my career is pretty much over before it starts, you know, in many ways. So they're saying, this simply cannot continue. And they feel like if the system's broken, and right now, in some ways, in many ways, it is, and it is rigged for a segment of people, that this is just, you know, unjust. And we're going to have, you know, we tell people to play by the rules and do this and everything else, and still they're not, they don't get rewarded for it, or certainly, you know, or be considered for it. Then that's the reality. That's when people start to rebel. And that's what revolutions tend to start from. People say revolutions start from the poor. The poor don't start revolutions. The poor follow. Revolutions start from the middle class, and they start from the intellectuals. That's where revolutions start from. Yeah, and when you get a lot of people today in a society like us, we're highly technology people. People are highly tech, out of work, unhappy, and angry about a lot of things. That is a recipe for disaster. So,
they feel like they have nothing to lose.
Exactly. And that's where, you know, the elite food crafts need to be very, very nervous, because I think right now they don't, if they feel that's, you know, there's, we've seen history doesn't take kindly to that, to plutocrats who have been very indifferent or hostile toward. And I would say we're not too far away from that. And I think that in many ways, you even have people who are very wealthy people like Abigail Disney and others are saying themselves, look, we better close these wealth gaps, and we better start doing things, writing articles and papers, because right now they know history. They're not great. You know,
absolutely.
And this is just, you know, people, this indifference toward it is very, very going to, you know, could very well end up being a downfall. Let's use, as we say in health, they're saying you better start getting preventative before it acting, you know, before it gets too, you know, before it's too late to
out of control. Yeah. So we got a lot to think about and a lot to figure out what the action steps are. But I do want us to have a chance to really delve into this whole thing of pedophilia, because the Epstein Files has been going on for a while, and I try to keep it out there that those survivors still have not got the justice that they deserve. And in fact, this administration is doubling down on not making sure they get what they need. And so I've concluded that we will never get the, excuse me, the files released. And so let's look at a plan B. But the whole phenomenon of pedophilia is very interesting and disturbing. And I think we don't have enough discussion about it, Elwood. And just recently in St. Louis, and some of my listeners might have already heard this, there was a pimp who was sending an Uber to Epworth Children's Home, which is a residential home for troubled youth. And this girl was being trafficked. Now, I think she was 16 or something. So this was going on for a while. And so now there's an attorney for this young person who's saying they have records or information to show that the institution was aware of that. So this notion of, and we know what the Catholic Church has done over decades and decades, and when young children are trafficked, it's really it's not just traumatic. It really ruins their lives, and some of them take their lives because of it. But now it's so prevalent, and we're seeing that the ruling classes believe that women and children are expendable and that they are either punching bags or sex objects. And so the senator, the elected official that now is under scrutiny because he abuses child and wife, and apparently other women. That seems to be the norm. So when people like hear about, oh, such and such was beating his wife, or they got, these women on the side, or young people on the side that they are having inappropriate affairs with, this really, to me, goes to the heart of the morality of this country. What is it that we are not protecting and saving and nurturing young people that we think that they are expendable, disposable, and that all that they are worth right now is for the pleasure of rich men? And so this came close to home. One, you wrote about it with the Tate brothers, and I want you to talk about why you felt compelled to write that. But one of our Black commentator contributors has been absent because they've been dealing with a pedophile in their church. And when I saw that man's history, and I'm talking about Charles Eccles, and this church over in Massachusetts has been like around for a while, but this man has wreaked havoc, and in an arrogant way. I mean, these people get busted, and they like, I ain't going nowhere. Just no. These people got to be dealt with. But there is a certain passivity when it comes to protecting children and not speaking up on their behalf, particularly if it's somebody with authority and power. And I'm just saying, we got to get over that. We really have to get over that. So talk about your article, this last article in blackcommentator.com, and why you centered on the infamous Tate brothers and the sickening stuff that they've been doing for years. And their influence is on social media. So, like, what are we doing?
Exactly. I mean, they were the class example. They were involved in, pedophilia. They were involved in rape. They were involved in blackmail. I mean, you can't get much. I mean, I put in the word. I call them demons. They're human demons. There's no other polite way to describe them. Now, some people might take offense to that, but those men were demons, are demons. If you do stuff like that, you're a demon. You're a human demon. Okay. End of story. There's no debate with me on that. So yeah, I mean, they were just awful. I mean, in Romania, they were over Europe doing it. They probably did some things here in the United States that were probably haven't been exposed yet. But I'm saying they were Trump supporters, and they had a lot of male followers on their podcast and like that. They're sexist, they're misogynist. I mean, racist. I don't know so much about that, but I think that some people now, it's rumored that they're biracial. I don't know if they're, they're supposedly, there's rumor that they're half black. I don't know they, if that's true or
They don't
not.
look it, but what do we know?
We don't know. We don't know. And that still don't, I don't care what they are. They could, I mean, they could have been black as the ace of spades. If they, whatever they still did, what they did was wrong. You ain't gonna get no defense from me because you're black. If you do stuff like that, I don't care who you are. Ain't no way in the world I'm defending pedophilia and rapes and things like that. I don't care who, what the race of the person is. Okay, wrong is wrong. And I have, you wanted one thing to set me off, be abusive to older people and young kids, the very vulnerable populations that can largely not defend themselves. And that sets me off. So I have no use for what these men have done. And I focused on them because they were, like I said, it was the abominable what they did. And it just goes back, it's going larger to the Trump administration and their views on how they see women, how they see those who are marginalized, and how they see those who they feel are not white, male, what, heterosexual or whatever. And we're seeing that right now with the current other candidate. I don't know, he's not, he's, I forget what state he's from, but he's the one whose wife, the guy, his congressman, his daughter was married to a Miller, Max Miller. And he's under right now. They're going to open up an investigation in Congress about him now, apparently, about his abuse, of women and stuff. These men, Corey Lewandowski, I think he was involved in an abusive affair, and there was a couple others in the Trump administration. The first one, these men were, several of these women said that their husbands, beat them, and all kind of things as well. These people see women as sex objects. They see women as, they see, as not having any rights, and they just see them as basically subordinate. And we've seen that with abortion rights laws. We've seen that how, predominantly Alabama State Senate voting on telling women what they do with their bodies. As well as I do, if abortions, if men could get pregnant and get abortions, it wouldn't even be an issue. You could get abortions at car washes, you could get abortions at McDonald's, you could get them at mini market and everything else. It wouldn't even be,
Probably free.
right. It wouldn't even be up for debate. Okay. That's just about power and control. I have my issues about abortion and reproductive rights and stuff like that as well. I don't, I'm not necessarily, I'm more, I let your conscience be your guide. I don't think people should get them for the sake of getting it if your child's gonna be healthy. But the reality is, if a woman's been the victim of rape, if the mother's got children home already, her life's in danger, and that child's in danger, or the child's been a victim of incest, yes, that I don't even consider that an abortion. First of all, I don't even consider that abortion. There's no reason in the world you should be carrying a child to term that you did not, that you've been the victim of rape, or if you got children home already, you, that child, other than that, fetus hasn't been born yet, or the child who's been a victim of adult incest. No, I don't even consider that an abortion. I just consider that common sense. That is terminating an unwanted and unintended pregnancy.
Yeah, right. But I always say trust women, trust black women, because they know their bodies, they know their lives, and so their decisions ought to be the last stop. I'm wondering though, I know that you talked about the connection with Trump, and I had read that Barron Trump was a particular
Yes.
su supporter of these brothers, and that it was because of Barron that when the first extradition came for the Tate brothers, there was intervention by the president.
Right.
And then when they came to the States, guess what state they came to? They came to
Florida.
Florida thinking they would be safe, and the UK came after them. But I think that this is what I always have to keep saying, like connecting the dots, because these people are not strangers to Trump or this global network of people who are into trafficking kids and sexually abusing them. But I do want to make a distinction between pedophilia has at least two streams. One of them, and this is from my background of children and youth, is that when children are sexually abused, they end up becoming abusers themselves. And so some of those pedophiles were sexually abused, and somebody didn't protect them. Now, trying to figure out who, what, I see that very different from trafficking, sex trafficking of children. But I just want to put that in there because I've known some of those kids who've been abused and they had nobody in the home to support or protect them, and neither did they have systems that also protected them. And sometimes they were put back into the home where there were people
The abuse
abusing
was
them.
starting. Yeah. It was like an endless cycle.
So can you talk about the global nature of this stuff and how maybe it looks like this pimp that was going to a children's home to pick up a child to traffic her hooks up into, like the Tate brothers, hooks up into the Epstein files?
Oh Lord, where do we begin? I think that it's just it's I guess
And maybe the starting point, Elwood, would be how do somebody like the Tate brothers get to be popular based on what they were doing? It was no secret what they were doing, but yet they had this big social media following. So what was up with that? What made them so appealing to other people, even sometimes even women?
Well, it was the image they project. I mean, they both worked out. They had strong bodies, and they were, they touted, they were, I guess, they were sort of flashy. They had clothes, they had nice clothes, cars, a glamorous lifestyle. For a lot of men, that's aspirational. Young men, in particular, and particularly men from all backgrounds, but especially men who are working class and stuff, were looking to probably aspire, up and stuff. So they had that image. That's one of the reasons Trump was so popular among a lot of men, because he basically, he had a beautiful wife, Melania. He had the, he had the, the guy, he had this kind of swagger, but he's powerful. He did what he wanted to do. He had all this money, and a lot of men looked up to that. That was kind of, they feel that was, that is quote unquote what real manhood is like, and what a real man is. Now, I'm just saying that's not what my belief is. I'm just saying, but that's what a lot of those men aspire to. And I think the Tate brothers were similar. There's a fair amount of incels out there, and on those incel, all those chat rooms, like that, who feel that a lot of these men, they attracted a variety, a slew of men. I don't think it was just one type of man they attracted. They attracted men who were, probably alpha males, men who were definitely sexist, misogynist, xenophobic, homophobic as well. They attracted that segment. I think they also attracted another group of men who aspired to power. They saw them as powerful. They who feel that women should be trad wives or subordinate and quote unquote, know their place in society. I also think they tried, they attacked a segment of men who are also probably a lot of bitter guys. Let's put it out here, a lot of bitter guys who have never really had probably too much luck with women and have been kind of rejected by women and never have had a lot of luck. And I think a lot of them are probably what I call them, bitter, sour bachelors in some cases, who've been, rejected by women most throughout their lives. And I think have gotten a certain age and still, feel that, they are resentful of women and feel that anything that women get inflicted upon them, they quote unquote deserve, whatever they resentful toward women. So I think they appeal to that segment of men too. And I think, so there's a lot of, I don't think it's just one type of man. I think there's a lot of factors, a lot of segments of men's in male society that these men appeal to,
Now you're talking about like the outward image of these folks as being appealing, and made the example of Trump, rich, famous, got this, got that. But in both cases, people were aware of their misogynist beliefs and actions. I mean, what is
But they
causing
didn't see
people?
it as misogyny. I'm saying a lot of these other men didn't see that as misogyny. I'm saying the ones that they appeal to, that they don't know what, they probably don't even know what
So
the
rape is not misogynistic? That somebody's been raped, and you thinking that's like fun and games, and you bragging about that? That's not disturbing to the
is.
average person.
For some men, yeah, I think some men wouldn't care about it. I think some men think that there's a, they've done, Jamal, they've done research. A lot of men said they take a woman out for dinner, they feel they have a right to have sex to her body. They've done that. I mean, this is not new. I teach gender studies. I've seen this stuff. I mean, there are people who feel, the incels, you go to those chat rooms and things like that as well. They're saying themselves, yeah, they feel that, what was it, Nick Fuentes said, my body, your body, my choice. I'm saying, I mean, though, so yes, there are men out there who definitely feel that way. Yes, they feel that, years ago, why do you think so many women did not even report rape? Because they knew the conviction
Well,
rate.
they still don't report it.
New
And
Hampshire's not
we
great.
see why.
Correct. In 1962, there was a man in New Hampshire, a woman took her husband to court in 1962, and the court said, no, he was married to you, so he had the right to have sex with you. And she said he had sex to get away. Who's that woman in Oregon in 1970? Greta Rida. I was real little when it happened, but she took her husband to court. Remember, she said he raped her. It was Greta Rida. It was, you probably can Google that, but she...
Yeah.
Her husband for raping her, and I said as well, and that was an Oregon. I'm saying to me, I don't became in that case. I didn't file that one, but I know yes, throughout history, there are certain states, and particularly in southern states and other states, that if you were married to a man, he could force his will on you because they did not consider that.
Yeah, rape. You were property of him. You were his property.
Right. Well, that goes far back as the laws of coverture in the colonial area, where a woman's property became her husband's when she got married to him, and certain. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying to me. So no, to answer your question, no, it's as shocking as it sounds. No, I know. I do. Yes, I do believe there are men who feel that way. Yes, absolutely. And that's wrong, but they do.
And I know there's men that feel that way. So that the question was probably more rhetorical, but I'm also wondering about other people who see this as heinous, who then like turn ahead and say, well, you know, that's stupid or that's whatever. But we really never intervene, or we really don't have a conversation to make sure that the folks around us are not engaging in similar activities. And I saw this with the Catholic Church, because I know some of the folks who were victims of the Catholic Church, and how the silence was real. And the silence is real in families when there's incest. And so I think for us having the conversation about sex, sexuality, what's real, what's not, what's love, what's you know, power, what's pain, we need to have a more open discussion about that. So when I saw that you had written about the Tate brothers, I said, like, this fits right in with this whole dynamic about sexuality and who gets to enjoy it at the expense of women and children. That's what it is now.
Or it gets to exploit it, not even enjoy it, exploit it. I mean, who get to exploit it? And I think they're a good example of people who did abuse the power, exploited it, manipulated it, and engaged in it, took advantage of it, you know, just perverted it. I mean, whatever, any kind of term you can use. I mean, they you know, they engage in all that. Now, the Trump administration said they don't plan on intervening. We'll see. I mean, you know, because but I think that they don't plan on, they shouldn't. But I feel that it wouldn't surprise me if you see that, you know, something eventually occurred, you don't hear much about it, or the case is quietly, you know, or you hear much about it, they quietly, you don't hear much about them, and they lay low, you don't hear about Tate brothers for another 10, 11 years, you know, so I'm saying, but so I think, that could possibly be the case. I mean, but we'll see. Hopefully they will be brought to justice.
Right, right.
You know, what does occur in that particular case. But yes, I think they a lot of men can unfortunately identify with what those men represent, with what the Tate brothers represent. And that's sad, but it is reality.
It is reality, and it's a reality that I think we have to change, or we are going to have generations of damaged children who grow up to be damaged adults, and then who also engage in not just self-destruction, but community destruction, where, you know, other people then are in part of that particular circle. So I wish we would just have more honest and open discussions about it. But it's something about sex in this country that we try to make mysterious or forbidden, so that there's no discussion about it. And I think a lot of that is based on the church and people's understanding of scripture, or their misunderstanding of scripture. But a lot
of it has to do with, because we're a very young country when it comes to, compared to our European countries, our European neighbors and African neighbors and our South American neighbors. America is one of the youngest as an infant compared to the rest of the world. And we came from a puritanical society. Jonathan Edwards, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. I mean, so, you know, our talk about sexuality has always been very, very, we're attitudes tend to be a little more concerned about it. We're supposed to not, those are things you're not supposed to talk about in public, you know.
Right, right.
European magazines, quite frankly, it's not unusual to see nude men and women in magazines, because they look at the human body as something to be, it's just part of human nature. They edit violence in their country, but they show sex on TV. And when I say sex, I mean nude bodies. But we in the United States, we edit sex, but we show violence. Now, what is more harmful for people to see on a regular basis, particularly young people and children? You know, right. We're a very hypocritical society in a lot of ways. Let's say we see a little baby running around. We see a little baby's bottom on television. People are like, ah, that's so cute. Our little kids, one of my friends was telling me when his child was two, I get kids about ready to go to college now. It was him and a group of other kids about two, between two and three or whatever, four. They all just took off their clothes and started running around the place naked, and everybody fell out laughing. Da, 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 and look at these little kids. Now, that would have been a group of adults. I mean, people would call the cops and everything else on them. I'm just saying, my point is, but I now realize that what we said, our attitudes about sexuality in the nation is just so.
Yeah, we've taken the innocence out of it and made it all criminal when the real criminals are getting away with so much. I want to thank you, Elwood, for joining me today for Black Commentator Roundtable. I want to say Black Commentator Dialogue. If for the month of August, Black Commentator is on hiatus, but the editor still puts the best of the articles from previous times on there. So it's not like the site is dead. And if you get a chance to read Elwood's article about the Tate brothers, please do. This is Black August, and so lots of stuff happening. Next week in St. Louis is Black Pride, and the theme this year is Homecoming, honoring our legacy, celebrating our future. And there's going to be a big thing down at the Marriott Hotel, the Bad Boys versus the Baddies audition. So it's going to be fun stuff, but hopefully it's going to be some political stuff, brunch and all of that. So go to their website or their Facebook page for more information. Also next week, I think it's next week, is going to be, by popular demand, the Mill Creek Play is coming back. And so if you missed it last week because the tickets were sold out, you get another chance to do that. So just check and see what's going on, but let's continue the momentum coming out of the elections, which I'm, like I said, thanking the voters of Missouri for those no to amendments 4 and 5, because they were going to change really the course of this state for years to come. And so we're on it. You are the fourth branch of government, and we're going to make it happen. We're going to turn this thing around. Thank you for listening. This is Jamala Rogers, your host. Voices from the Battlefield, and you can see any past shows on JamalaRogers.com. or my YouTube channel. So be safe out there. Thank you for listening.
Likewise.
All right.
Right now.